This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
Free and uncorrupted communication.
First, I would like to thank Richard and Bill for giving me the rare opportunity to share with you what I have been thinking about for the last, and maybe working and struggling for the last decade. And that is my humble contribution to the grand discussion that I've heard the last 2 days on globalization. And my contribution is humble because my desire is to bring the margin to the center. And who is at the margin? Women, poor third world women who are brutalized by globalization. And when I say the experience of third world women must be at the center of our discussion and discourse and study of globalization, I like to dissect what this third world women's experience is first. And I can only do it in 8 minutes. I have already wasted 2 minutes. First, when I say women's experience, I would like to refer to the experience of third world poor women who are most brutalized by globalization and the structural adjustment policies of the IMF. And that experience should also include in our study and our conceptualization of globalization that has been very much Western-dominated in terms of discourse and theorization, what these women are doing to resist globalization. And this should be simultaneously addressed in order to present third world women not only as victims of globalization, but how they are also constructing their agency within the particular context of their everyday lives. And by looking at their resistance, especially grassroots women, peasant women who are displaced by transnational corporations, women who are trafficked as in sex trade, as domestic workers, and many other areas such as mail order brides. If we look at their experience and their resistance, it is telling us that they are at the bottom, also doing theory about globalization, and transnational feminist scholarship must give that a voice. When I say third world women, I should not and we should not think of third world women as homogeneous. And Chandra Mohanty has also reiterated that. That there are women who are in fact also privileged and get privileges through globalization. When I'm talking about third world women, I would like us to understand that there are women who, because of their class position in the political economy, are most brutalized. And so, when I say making the experience of third world women become a center in our study of globalization, I would like to propose that when we talk about transnational feminist scholarship in the context of globalization, let us begin our analysis and our standpoint should take the experience of poor third world women as the beginning or the vantage point of our analysis. The study of third world women becoming the center of our analysis of globalization, I would like to propose the transnational feminism in the context of globalization must have two projects. One is shaping a transnational feminist scholarship that gives voice to the third world women whose experience has been marginalized in mainstream-dominated or mainstream Western-dominated discourse on globalization. The other project is shaping a transnational activism that creates a counter-hegemonic resistance to globalization that puts centrality to the experience of third world women who, because of their position in the political economy, are most vulnerable to exploitation. The feminist scholar activist bridges these two projects. Now, let me just say that the first project, one of its tasks is to unravel the dynamics of globalization that creates ties that bind and divide women, that divide and bind women and men, and ties that divide and bind families, bringing children into the picture. The second dimension of the first project is epistemological, re-examining how we study the dynamics of globalization. Let me just say that in unraveling the ties that divide, there is something that comes into my mind. I'm working now based on my research. I've been looking at the labor export of the Philippines. And I have looked at domestic workers in Rome, in Italy, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, in Vancouver, and in Chicago. And what this is telling me is that globalization cannot just be conceived as a flow of finances, a flow of commodities, that now globalization is also a flow of people, where people are commoditized now as sources of profit, both by, for the government, in order to pay its foreign debt. The Philippines, for example, has embarked a labor export policy. And it is a global trend that women are the majority of labor export. The second project transnational feminism must address that I was talking about should also include how we study. In the earlier panel, we were talking about that, discourse, voice. And from my own experience, both as a researcher and a feminist activist, I'm part of the women's movement also in the Philippines and its branch here in the United States, which is called Gabriela Network. I can see that one of the things that we can learn from in studying globalization and bringing this at the center, the experience of third world poor women, is to learn from the feminist research. And I'm trying that in my own research. Arjun Appadurai, in his grassroots globalization and the research imagination, began to raise the methodological issue in studying globalization. He points out the importance of voice, perspective, or location in the study of global capitalism, and advocates an epistemology that does not turn the more marginal regions of the world merely as producers of data for the theory mills of the North. This requires, he argues, a commitment to the study, to study the dynamics of globalization from below, and third world poor women are below, its institutions, horizons, and vocabularies as it confronts globalization from above. He thus sees the connection between pedagogy, a la Paulo Freire, activism, and research. To address this issue, I would like to propose that we must learn from feminist research. Transnational feminist scholarship has these important features that we can learn from. Feminist research has these three features: standpoints, reflexivity, positionality, and immersion. The feminist standpoint, I think, in line with Jutta Sen and Karen Crown, who suggest that we begin our inquiry from the experience and perspective of third world women, because third world women comprise the majority of the world's poor, and they suffer both economic, social, and gendered forms of domination. Reflexivity allows us to connect our lives with the people we study. And positionality allows us to examine our place in this hierarchy. We who are women, especially us who are in the academe, who are also in a way privileged by globalization, how are we related to the structures of domination that subjugate the people and the poor women that we study? And that analysis should also be part of data that we call data. However, immersion is also important to study women whose voice we are bringing into the discourse. Immersion requires that we be physically present and feel how they actually experience both their emotions and passions about globalization. Immersion also means devising ways to have some form of continuing connections with the communities or people we study, so that even after we leave the field, we continue to be part of their activism. So then, research becomes a bridge between women's activism and the academe. Research takes a political dimension when we give voice to the muffled, silenced voices of the oppressed, the exploited, and we can begin to give them voice in our thinking, in our theorizing. Now, the second project, activism project of transnational feminism, I see, for example, Gabriela, the National Coalition of Women's Movement in the Philippines, which is the more militant voice of the women's movement in the Philippines, as both transnational, both local and transnational. And it has addressed some of the issues that I have talked about, sex trafficking of women, and it has, in fact, expanded the concept of trafficking to include also domestic workers who are facing extreme exploitation in the host countries that, for example, are dependent on foreign labor. Do I still have one more? Okay. In conclusion, then, what I would like to say is that, because I have only 1 minute, if we look at the activism of women from below, there are many theories, that grand theories that we can modify. For example, the UNIFIL, the resistance movement of women, domestic workers in Hong Kong. They have formed, for example, ethnic alliances in order to confront the host government that is trying to divide them as domestic workers and to lower their wages when there was this Asian financial crisis. Because of these inter-ethnic alliances, they were able at least to confront the host government and to demand some changes. in policies of the Hong Kong government. In the Philippines, the same thing. We are trying to confront the Philippine government to have some autonomy to be able to protect the rights of its migrant citizens in different parts of the world. Now we have more than 6 million Filipino men and women exported in 126 countries, more than that. And majority of these are women. So from this theorizing, we can see that what they demand is an alternative transnational state who can cross borders, a state that can cross borders and protecting the rights and human rights of its migrant citizens. And a host government that is also transnational in a sense, not only in importing labor and exploiting this imported labor, but also to talk about and think about of labor as transnational in a sense that it has also a right both for organizing labor, right, political rights, in order to demand human rights as migrants within the host government. So here we see, at least in my own experience, that there are some theories being created by people at the bottom. And that is what I mean by bringing the experience of third world poor women at the center of our analysis.
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank Richard and Bill once again for this marvelous conference. In my discussion of global feminisms, I'm going to draw your attention to the emergence of a women's organization of a new type, which I have been calling the Transnational Feminist Network. And what I'm going to talk about this afternoon and what I talked about yesterday, too, draws on my forthcoming book, which, inshallah, will be published next year or the year after next. If I may also shamelessly plug another book, my first book, Modernizing Women, Gender, and Social Change in the Middle East, will appear in June in its second updated edition. Now, what is a transnational feminist network? It's a network of women from three or more countries who come together around a common agenda. Reproductive health and rights, violence against women, women's human rights, peace and anti-militarism, feminist economics. A great deal has been written about women's human rights activism, but less about the feminist critique of neoliberal economics or about new forms of women's organizing and mobilizing, and this despite the recent proliferation of studies on transnational social movements, transnational advocacy movements, global social movements, and so on. In my own research, I examine transnational feminist networks, their research, advocacy, and lobbying efforts, the way they have organized global networks of women, how they engage with states, international organizations, and the transnational public sphere to accomplish their goals. And what I argue is that transnational feminist networks are the organizational expression of the transnational women's movement and are guided by a set of ideas and goals that may be referred to as global feminism. Transnational feminist networks of the present wave, because there was an earlier wave, emerged around 1985, and they have proliferated since then. And what I have focused on are those transnational feminist networks that deal primarily with economic policy and with Muslim women's rights. In particular, I've been analyzing three feminist networks that formed in opposition to structural adjustment and neoliberal economic policy, developing a feminist critique and an alternative feminist economics framework, And I have been examining three feminist networks that promote women's human rights, especially in Muslim countries where Islamic fundamentalism emerged in the 1980s and the legal status of women became compromised. Well, why did transnational feminist networks emerge when they did? What was the context? As we know, these feminist networks emerged really in the sort of tail end of second wave feminism, and second wave feminism was primarily nationally based and nationally oriented, and in fact, differences emerged in the first and second UN World Conferences on Women, Mexico City 1975 and Copenhagen 1980, where a really serious north-south divide was also manifest. But a shift began to take place in the mid-1980s during preparations for the UN's Third World Conference on Women, which was held in Nairobi in 1985. The shift took the form of bridge building and consensus making across those regional and ideological divides, and what emerged was this women's organization of a new type that brought together women from north and south. What was that new context in which this shift took place? Well, we can identify three major influences. The first, of course, is sociodemographics, the demographic changes and the growth of a population of educated, employed, mobile, and politically conscious women around the world. The second set of factors has to do with what I think are some of the defining features or effects of globalization. Reaganism, Thatcherism, economic crisis, structural adjustment, feminization of poverty, and Islamic fundamentalism. All of these were sort of coalescing, gelling, etc., ruining people's lives, including women's lives, in the 1980s. And the third important factor, I think, has to do with ideas and ideologies and intellectual currents and trends. The UN Decade for Women, which officially began in 1976 and went on through 85, the emergence of this women in development and the spread of this women in development and gender and development paradigm, and of course the emergence and spread of feminist ideology in the developing world. So the mid-1980s, I mean, it was precisely this time, 1984, 1985, that we saw the formation of, for example, DAWN, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era, VLOOM, Women Living Under Muslim Laws, WIDE, Women in Development Europe, SIGI, the Sisterhood is Global Institute. The beginning of the 1990s saw the emergence of, for example, the Women's Environment and Development Organization, WEDO, and the Association of Women of the Mediterranean Region, the AWMR. And, you know, in the interest of disclosure, I should say that I'm a member of AWMR and of WIDE. And other transnational feminist networks, of course, formed around women's health issues and some of the other issues that I mentioned earlier. Of course, communications and information exchange among these transnational feminist networks and between members were facilitated by advances in the information and computer technologies. And today we see, many transnational feminist networks organized around these different issues that I mentioned earlier, and most of them have very extensive websites. So the ITC has been important for them. Now, what is it that transnational feminist networks do, and what do they want? Well, most recently, these feminist networks have been mobilized around the war on Iraq, and there's been a great deal of activity and a lot of petition writing and so on in that regard. But more specifically, what they do are the following. First, they create and activate global networks to mobilize pressure outside states. For example, Women Living Under Muslim Laws and the Sisterhood is Global Institute have released numerous action alerts and electronic petition drives pertaining to violations of women's human rights in Muslim countries. Transnational feminist networks also build and take part in coalitions such as Jubilee 2000, the Coalition to End the Third World Debt, 50 Years is Enough, Women's Eyes on the Bank, Women's International Coalition for Economic Justice, and the Women in Trade Network. These are just some examples of the kinds of coalitions that they have either formed themselves or joined. Second, they participate in multilateral and intergovernmental political arenas. For example, they observe and they address ECOSOC at the UN. They consult UN agencies, regional commissions, and the OECD DAC. They submit documents to intergovernmental meetings. For example, they took part in the UN's Financing for Development Conference that took place in Monterrey, Mexico last year. They lobby delegates and they cultivate supporters. The purpose of this kind of interaction with the intergovernmental organizations is to raise new issues such as gender and trade, gender and macroeconomics, and women's human rights, and to hopefully affect policy. The third thing that they do is that they act and agitate within states to enhance public awareness and participation. Transnational feminist networks work with labor and progressive religious groups, the media, and human rights groups on social policy, humanitarian and development issues, and militarization. For example, WIDE Austria, that is the Austrian branch of Women in Development Europe, several years ago was very active in the area of trying to liberalize immigration policy in Austria, and that in the context of a very conservative and xenophobic government. In Pakistan, the Women Living Under Muslim Law branch, Shirkat Gah, based in Lahore, has organized many protests against patriarchal laws in Pakistan and for Afghan women's human rights. The Association of Women of the Mediterranean Region has worked with WILF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for many years around peace and demilitarization issues in the Mediterranean region, and they've tirelessly, you know, passed resolutions and sent petitions to their national governments. So transnational feminist networks link with local partners, they take part in local coalitions, and they provoke or take part in public protests. And those feminist networks that focus on economic policy issues promote social democratic policies, such as, you know, they've endorsed the Tobin tax, the 2020 compact, socioeconomic rights, ILO labor standards, gender budgets, the valorization of women's unpaid work. These are some of their key demands and issues that they work around. And those feminist networks that work on women's human rights monitor governments. For example, Women Living Under Muslim Law submitted a shadow report on Algeria to the Committee on Ending Discrimination Against Women. And this shadow report that Vloom produced was equally critical of the Algerian state and of those Islamist groups that were terrorizing women in Algeria in the 1990s. Other such networks produce reports on countries' implementation of the Beijing Platform for Action. There's a lot of activity in this regard, too. Whether working at the state, regional, or global levels, transnational feminist networks have framed issues and introduced new concepts, such as engendering development, feminization of poverty, the care economy, women living under Muslim laws, that's a new concept, women's rights are human rights. Many of these concepts have been adopted by major international organizations, including UN organizations, the World Bank, and the donor agencies of the core countries. And a new concept, reinventing globalization, was the focus of two transnational feminist network conferences in 2002, the Association for Women's Rights in Development and the Association of Women of the Mediterranean Region. In fact, transnational feminist networks contribute several new ideas to current discussions of and collective action around globalization. One idea pertains to the state. For transnational feminists, the state still matters as an institutional actor. Even though they reject nationalist politics in favor of internationalism and transnational solidarity, the state matters to women, especially in the areas of reproductive rights and family law. And this has been especially important to Muslim women who have been fighting around the reform of family law in various Muslim countries. And the state also matters because transnational feminists oppose the neoliberal state and favor the welfarist, developmentalist form of the state that is also woman-friendly. Thus, the focus of their activities is simultaneously the state, the region, it could be the Mediterranean, Latin America, the European Union, and the global economy and institutions of global governance. A second idea pertains to understandings and definitions of globalization, and I'm glad that Susan George said what she did this morning. Transnational feminists are not anti-globalization. They are anti-liberal, anti-neoliberal capitalism, but they view globalization as a multifaceted phenomenon whose most positive feature is its opportunities for transnational networking and solidarity. They would, in fact, like to help reinvent globalization and to reorient it from a project of markets to a project of peoples. Their literature is replete with condemnations of the ills of neoliberal capitalism, but their stated solutions and strategies are to remake, to democratize, and to engender global governance, not to destroy it. A third and final distinctive idea that I will mention pertains to the transnational feminist call for gender justice. This call has been made in the context of cooperation with the broader global economic justice movement and campaigns such as Jubilee 2000. Transnational feminists do not want women's rights, including and especially reproductive rights, to be placed on the back burner or postponed until after the triumph of the anti-globalization movement, as has been the case with so many national political movements. But they also believe that global economic justice is rendered a meaningless abstract concept without consideration of the gendered and racial makeup of the working people or the working families. Without due consideration of the sexual division of labor and the care economy, of the traffic in women's bodies, of working women's civil rights, of their rights to bodily integrity, to reproductive rights, and of the need to establish women's social rights, paid maternity leaves, paternity leaves, quality childcare, there can, in fact, be no economic justice for women. As such, their slogan, gender justice and economic justice, may be understood as a variation of the slogan, women's rights are human rights, both of which are key concepts of global feminism that have been developed and disseminated by transnational feminist networks. Thanks.
Good afternoon. Thank you to our organizers and all of the dozens of unpaid workers who've made this event possible. It's really been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed being here. It's like taking seminars all day long. I have some general remarks on globalization, kind of an aerial view of the discourse. And then I want to kind of move us into deep into the heart of our closest global city, Los Angeles, and look at some of the spaces of collective action, spaces of hope, where Mexican and Central American immigrant women whose lives have been completely contextualized by globalization are responding in small and large ways. But first, globalization, right? The dimensions of globalization, and so I think this bit have been noted, tend to be very big, right? Macrostructural, political economy, circuits of trade and capital flows, structural adjustment policies and entities like the IMF, the World Bank, WTO. We also have a lot of binaries that we deal with here, almost like another axis of good and evil. But what gets defined in good and evil is different depending on the different camps. But on the good side, we have, you could probably read Time magazine and sort of see the celebration of capitalist corporate triumph and neoliberalization. Or we could look at, you know, spaces of hope and resistance. And on the bad, you know, exacerbated inequalities, of course. And then we have a whole realm of entities, nations, bodies, practices that are understood by these, you know, kind of really couched by these binaries, right? Rich countries versus poor, north, south, corporate, white, you know, masters of the universe and the corporations, laboring women in the third world, and so on. When globalization is portrayed in the concrete, it tends to be studied and seen in places far away, from us here, far away from Santa Barbara, right? Maybe sweatshops in Los Angeles. But I think it's important to understand it, continue to try to understand globalization as it's embedded in part of our daily lives. When we add feminism into the picture, a number of questions arise. How does globalization affect women? How does globalization affect particular groups of women? And relations between different groups of women and definitions of feminist issues. There's been a lot of conversation here about different ways of looking at the parameters of globalization, mostly we have centered on global economic restructuring, increased capital and labor mobility, increasing deterritorialization of nation-state entities, privatization of previously publicly financed institutions, cuts in social provisioning, and so on. There's a good body of literature, and much of it created by our panelists here, that has looked at the different ways all of these features of globalization have affected women's activism in very local venues, beyond the transnational entities that were networks that were just pointed out. Nancy Naples, Manisha Desai, Amitra Basu, besides our panelists, are some of the people who've really focused on the local effects and responses of different groups of women. And that's kind of what I want to pick up with here. And I'm going to use the case of immigration, a key component of globalization. Something like 150 million people today live in nations different than the ones where they were born. And contrary to what most Americans think, not all of them are coming to the United States. In fact, there's about 30 million of that 150 million that are the foreign-born immigrant population of the United States. As all of you know, one of the key cities of immigration is Los Angeles, and the largest group of U.S.-bound migrants and immigrants in the United States today, far surpassing the number two and three groups, Filipino and Chinese, are Mexicans. About 8 million Mexicans nationals live in the United States today, many of them concentrated in cities like Los Angeles. Mexican and Central American immigrant women in Los Angeles have been deeply affected by a legacy of colonial-like relations with the United States dating back 153 years, a history of a direct labor recruitment program that focused on men but wound up really spawning, if you will, a much more diverse labor migration, NAFTA, and really a changing landscape of U.S. immigration laws, most of them passed in a real nationalist fervor to control our borders in the last 20 years, but laws that are actually very ineffectual and impotent in the faces of much larger, much more powerful economic and social forces. So how do global feminisms get expressed for largely Mexican and Central American women in Los Angeles? Well, I think mobilizations are less defined by Robin Morgan's old adage that sisterhood is global, and more defined by feminisms that are immediate, local, and often very of urgent concerns. So their mobilizations and collective actions often address the ways that global economic and political change have been manifested in their daily lives, situated in, to borrow Saskia Sassen's term, these global cities. I'm just going to give you two examples of local organizing efforts, one focusing on labor that many of you may be familiar with, and the other focusing on this notion of production of place and community safety. As a side note, that I want to note that in Los Angeles and in all Mexican, Salvadoran, Guatemalan communities in the United States today, there's a lot of transnational organizing going on in terms of hometown associations, federations, push for dual citizenship. And I want to note that those are largely appear to me to be very real male venues of collective action. I don't see women well represented in those forms of organizing. Let's take labor organizing. How many of you here saw the movie Bread and Roses? Well, the rest of you must immediately go out to Blockbuster tonight or tomorrow and rent Ken Loach's docudrama, Bread and Roses, a sort of a dramatized version of Justice for Janitors, the SEIU janitorial campaign that's had tremendous success in Los Angeles of the last 15 years or so. Mexican and Central American women are key segments of the janitorial labor force itself, which has been restructured and reorganized increasingly as a Latina immigrant woman's job, implying many transgressions of a sort I won't go into here. This comes on the heels of the janitorial industry that was restructured, downgraded, deunionized, you know, increasingly governed by subcontracting. And in the recent years, as covered by Bread and Roses and scholarship of many others, there's been a real forceful renewal of unionization, a real rise of social movement activism in which largely, you know, fueled by Mexican and Central American immigrant workers, women and men, taking to the streets, street theater, and drawing on really wide bases of community support, drawing on youth, clergy, churches, various organizations. Narratives of motherhood and family have been mobilized in this cause, and the key demand for the janitors in Los Angeles has been the issue of social reproduction, medical insurance, health benefits, and really addressing the absence of state-supported programs for families. Domestic workers have also organized in Los Angeles and similarly in Long Island, in D.C., in San Francisco, less easily under the larger, you know, the more familiar rubric of the trade union. But instead, we've seen a myriad of community worker associations spawn up with demands for dignity, respect on the job, use of the court system to go back for back wages owed, and real, you know, all different kinds of mobilizations seeking for job improvements. In instances such as these, in the janitorial domestic work industries, we see Mexicana and Central American women seeking to really change the quality of informal sector jobs in global cities like Los Angeles, jobs that otherwise appear invisible, lack basic health, safety, labor standards provisions, and often escape state and government regulations. The second instance I want to sketch of mobilization concerns community safety, this kind of notion of, Saskia also introduced, production of place. I think less widely recognized in the globalization literature than informal sector jobs is the quality of urban neighborhoods where the working poor live in global cities or in non-global cities. While global cities have their well-known glamour centers of hotels and financial district and high-end commercial and residential areas, they also all include sprawling urban neighborhoods characterized by substandard housing, lack of municipal services or services that are unevenly distributed, high rates of crime, poor schools, lack of green space, etc. In East LA, in a neighborhood called Boyle Heights, the poorest parish in Los Angeles County, in the Los Angeles Archdiocese, that other entity, Mission Dolores, has spawned a plethora of activist groups that are working to economically and politically enfranchise a community of mostly Mexican and Central American immigrants living in the shadow of just, you know, a tangle of freeways that run through the neighborhood and projects and a lot of gang violence. This Mission Dolores is just a hotbed, actually, of all different kinds of projects ranging from childhood education to Homies Unidos, which aims to sort of provide job rehabilitation for gang youth, housing, shelter, young adult leadership, etc. This is a neighborhood besieged through a lot of the 90s by a lot of gang violence and killings. When a 9-year-old girl was shot on her way home from school around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a group of women in this community organized and to address this, beginning at the church, and eventually fomented a community policing project. They got the city of Los Angeles to close down particular dangerous alleyways, in the process. It sounds like a very small thing, right? It doesn't look like the triumph over globalization exactly. But maybe if your child was walking down that alley, it would look like the triumph over some of those forces. In the process of doing that, they learned how to conduct press conferences, have petition drives, organize meetings with translations. They got the city to establish an anonymous tip line. And they made up green t-shirts for all of their members, and they stand on street corners and themselves provide a policed presence, a sort of safe passage for their children. So these are very courageous women. They're standing off face to face with local gang members, kind of patrolling the streets. And perhaps even more courageously, they're standing face to face with the mayor of Los Angeles and the police chief and various officials, also demanding better city policing services and other services for their neighborhood. Here, I think it's important, just to kind of reflect on both of these projects of community safety and production of place and labor. These projects are transformative and emancipatory and are small steps, but I think important steps that deserve to be recognized towards improving real community and labor outcomes for these women. But they're also important at the level of really transforming gender relations in the domestic sphere, the community level, in terms of leadership development. As one of the women in the community policing project told me, when she began the first meeting, she asked her husband permission if she could attend the meeting. She no longer asks permission, and that's, I think, a lot of all of this is about, learning not to ask permission. Thank you.
I want to start where I should have started earlier this morning, which is in recruitment. I forgot to mention that I had brought some newsletters that are available about the work of the 50 Years is Enough Network, the Economic Justice News it's called, and taking a leaf from Kevin Danaher, say that for $25 you can get this newsletter, you can subscribe to this newsletter and we'll get it in your very own mailbox every 2 months or so. Mention that we have a website, www.50years.org, www.50years.org. If you just want to talk to us on the phone, we have a very easy phone number, 202 IMF Bank. It's very easy, 463-2265. And for the students, since we are on campus, to say that we do have an internship program and we would love to have you come and work with us. We won't pay you, but we'll give you a really, real good education in the trenches in terms of what it means to be part of an activist organization. And I also want to mention that we have these postcards that are right up front here. You can get them after the plenary, that are directed to the Deputy Managing Director of the IMF on the question of their new rules in terms of what they're trying to tell the world needs to happen in order to deal with the question of debt. And I will leave my recruiting to that right there. And I also want to say that I feel very privileged and honored to have the opportunity to be on two plenaries today. And I have to say that for the people and the students of Santa Barbara, you've restored my faith, because I was, at the beginning of this plenary, I was really worried that it was going to be very, it's the one on feminism, on gender, and there were not going to be very many people. And I think that there's actually more people here than were at the last plenary, and I want to give yourselves a hand for that. Thank you for showing up. This is important stuff. I'm here because when I was 13, My mother decided to make a habit of sending me to her women's meetings when she couldn't go. And she would say, go tell them I can't make it, and since you're going to be there, can you stay and come and tell me what they talked about, because it'll take a while before the information gets out. And I got a really great education in terms of what was happening to women in Kenya and what were the issues that they were concerned about. And they were concerned about the education of their kids, they were concerned about nutrition, they were concerned about health, they were concerned about teenage pregnancy, and they were concerned about a lot of other issues of what was happening in their communities, about domestic violence, where the women would form kind of a social sanction against any man they knew was, you know, beating on his wife, so that when he walked around the village, there was small but significant sanctions that he got from other women in the community about what was wrong with that kind of behavior. And so because of my mother and my grandmother, I got on a path that literally today I'm here in Santa Barbara. And I think that this is the kind of education that especially a lot of young women find themselves having. If you ask my mother, she would not define herself as a feminist. But I couldn't think of a better poster woman for feminism. And in my language, there's no word for feminist or feminism, but the reality of the work and the kind of challenges that women are bringing within the social and cultural as well as political context in Kenya, it has very much to do with feminist values. From the UN, we learned that women are half the world's population. They perform nearly two-thirds of its work hours. They receive only one-tenth of the world's income. And they own less than one-hundredth of the world's property. That is a lot of women around the world. And when we look at globalization and corporate globalization, because I do like to sometimes make that distinction, it really depends on and exploits women's productive and reproductive capacities. What do I mean by this? With productive capacities, it's that the experience, as we all know, that in sweatshops, 80 to 90% of the people working in sweatshops, whether they're making shoes or textiles or whatever, it is women who are doing this work. In the case of the African continent, again from the United Nations, that 70% of the food consumed on the continent is produced by women farmers. And there are so many examples that we can talk about in terms of what women are doing in production in terms of the global economy. When we talk about women's reproductive capacities, women's bodies and sexuality are very much part of that. Whether we are talking about male older brides, whether we are talking about women who were hired and recruited to travel to many countries, as we heard before, to work as domestics, child prostitutes, and the so-called comfort women, that women's very bodies, women's very sexuality is part of that, and that their economies and that their, in some countries, the Philippines comes to mind, Thailand as well, that there's this piece of the economy that is very much dependent on the fact that women and women's sexuality is a piece of it. If you look in the context of the U.S., well, a lot of the male older brides come to the U.S., but going back to even to slavery, both women's productive and reproductive capacities were part of the slave economy, where women were expected to do certain works, and then, of course, they were expected to produce more children who would become slaves. My friend Virginia from the Anti-Privatization Forum in South Africa says that women are the rescue 911 of corporate globalization. What does she mean by this? I think that my own description of what that means is that when we talk, for instance, about structural adjustment programs, and I'm really please, that, you know, spending my days talking about the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. I'm very pleased to be here and to hear this constant analysis of the IMF and World Bank and their policies, in particular structural adjustment policies, and how they are active and how they impact all these different kinds of arenas and sectors of what we are talking about. I think the revolution is right on its way on this one. When we talk about structural adjustment programs and we talk, for instance, about privatization, which is one of the tenets of SAPS, is that it ends up with privatization, the burden of women's work and women's responsibility is added on. Whether it's water, when water gets privatized and women are cut off, then it means that they have to figure out where water is going to come from for their communities. In many places, women are already walking long distances to get water, but there are new communities now where this becomes a reality for women. When electricity gets cut off, it means that women, again, already walking in many communities, walking long distances to fetch firewood and find charcoal and all of that, that this is another aspect of that. When social spending cuts are made, another tenet of structural adjustment programs, on health, it means that women, not just in the Global South, but in many places have the responsibility of providing the nursing care of their families, whether there's a hospital or not. But when the hospital or the local clinic gets closed down, women are the ones who have to figure out how to meet their families' health care needs, whether they're going to find, you know, boil some roots or some bark or whatever it is that they're going to do, this becomes the responsibility of women almost exclusively. Education, when cuts in education happen, in many countries, in the Global South in particular, there's already a bias against the girl child, that when families have to make this decision about who gets an education, the girl child is the one who is a second-class citizen on this one. And when tuition fees or user fees are added, then forget it, that girls are not getting an education. When credit gets cut because of structural adjustment programs, there's almost often an increase in money available for cash cropping, which is often the province of men, and no credit for subsistence farmers, who are usually women. I give the example in Africa, and the numbers are quite high in other parts of the world as well. And so it's all of this is an ongoing struggle that women are facing. And they, in 1995 at the Beijing conference, where Mohamed Yunus of the Grameen Bank got honored, one of the things that was raised was that because of providing microcredit loans for women. And there was revealed that in terms of women paying back these loans, whether it's microcredit loans or other loans, that they pay at the rate of about 98% payment rate, which is higher than students paying back their student loans and businesses paying back bank loans. And so, you know, Mr. Wolfenson, who was very new at the World Bank then, had almost, you know, sort of this revolution. And actually the extent of his gender analysis or whatever is, he said a couple times about how he likes women and that his wife and his daughters are women or something like that. But I am not making this up, honestly. I couldn't. And so he decided that the World Bank was going to start a new project called CGAP, the Consultative Group to Assist the Poorest, which, you know, kind of disappeared from their programs. And the idea was that the World Bank was going to partner, in fact, with MasterCard and provide microcredit loans for women. And the one example of this that we heard was in Senegal, where the Association for the Promotion of Women, APROFES, had been working in this arena. And what would happen is that they would call meetings in villages and the workers would get up in the morning and start walking the distance to the villages to recruit women. And the workers who had been recruited by the World Bank in partnership with MasterCard would pass them by on little mopeds because, of course, of that connection, they had mopeds. And they would get into the village and sign in everyone up. By the time the APROFES women came by, you know, the meeting was over because they had already been recruited, and the women never knew the difference between that particular project and the one that had actually been, they had been called for. And so I'm going to make a jump without any transition because I see I'm actually practically out of time. 1 minute, 2 minutes? Okay. And I guess a transition is Rosalind Miles, in her book, The Women's History of the World, said that in the whole vast funhouse of history's jokes and tricks, there can be fewer greater ironies than the spectacle of women embracing and furthering the system which would all too soon attack their autonomy, crash their individuality, and undermine the very reason for their existence. And for me, in a more populist way, as one of my colleagues, Pam Spar, says, is that not every woman who wears a skirt is a sister. And when you look, and when you look at the international financial institutions, when you look at Seattle, when you look at a number of these places where, and you know, we can go through the names, Charlene Bachevsky, who was the U.S. Trade Representative at the time of Seattle, Madeleine Albright, Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi, Golda Meir, Hillary Clinton, the list is long. All of these women who are out there and who have a lot of power and access to a lot of power, but they are not putting forward a feminist analysis or a feminist perspective. In fact, for the most part, they're not even trying to raise the issues that that concern women. For the entire period of the Clinton years, the U.S. representative at the IMF and at the World Bank, the U.S. executive directors were women, but we did not see it make a difference in terms of what was happening to women. And so when I look at the question of globalization, this issue that we talked about earlier about resistance and alternatives becomes really important. And also the issue of analysis, feminist analysis and a feminist perspective, not just the numbers. And unfortunately, there are lots of people who spend a lot of time doing the bean counting about what percentages of women at the World Bank or at the Inter-American Development Bank or at this place or the other. But that is not going to make a very big difference if they lack a feminist analysis and a feminist perspective. Two quick closing points, again, jumping around. One of which is that when we look at the examples actually that were referred to in terms of these transnational feminist movements and alliances that are coming up all over the world, the influence that they're having, in particular, I'm thinking about the role that the World March of Women, for instance, has had in influencing the World Social Forum process, where this insistence on, in terms of a feminist analysis and inclusion of women with a feminist analysis and perspective has really changed the kinds of approaches and the analysis coming out of the World Social Forum. And that the last point to say is that even as I have described and we have all heard about all the struggles that women are involved in many places around the world, women are not victims. Women are survivors. And I mean, if you think about all the examples of the sweatshops and the domestics and the peasant farmers who are or whose rights are being violated and who are losing their land, and you think about all the places where women's labor is being exploited, but the creative things that women are doing within those contexts, I am more than ever convinced that women are not victims but survivors. And again, end by saying where I started, where I was this morning, to say that in terms of these issues, that women, again, are not looking for our sympathy, they are not looking for handouts, they are not looking for charity, they are looking for our solidarity, they are looking for justice, and that is our responsibility. And I think that you, by showing up here today, have started showing that, beginning to learn, and I challenge you to learn more and to tell the stories of what women are doing and how women are surviving and fighting corporate globalization. Thank you.
Who wants to follow that talk? I would also like to thank you. I would like to thank, firstly, Light Gurujo, Peter Chua, Dana Collins, and Molly Talcott, who are all students I've worked with over the last few years, who have refused to let me sit and be comfortable in my ideas, and who have therefore shown me ideas and pathways that I had never imagined in my life that I would ever see. They have pieces in a book that I have just co-edited with John Foran, and I just want to thank all of you for what you have done for me. I'd also like to thank my comrade and soulmate, John Foran. For those of you who have not lived outside the belly of the beast, you may not know how very hard it is to live here. Not just survive, but to actually have some pleasure, to enjoy your life here. And it is John Foran who has stuck with me, who has shown me through his intellectual commitment, his political solidarity, and his love for me, that I am determined to stay here and fight. Thank you, John. And I want to thank Bill and Rich for asking me to speak at this conference. This is an absolutely wonderful conference. Perhaps you don't know that I was a bit of a thorn in their side in some of the organizing meetings. And if I may be so bold as to make a couple of comments, in the context, perhaps, of saying to everyone in this room, not just to Bill and Rich, that you only criticize that which you love. And so when you offer critiques and comments, you do it to say, how might it be different in the future? And so I want to just pose a couple of questions and comments. This is the first panel that has not got an Anglo-European speaker on it. It is the women's panel. Today, we have had lots of panels that have had lots of people on them talking about alternatives. When we had the analyses, I might be forgiven perhaps for wondering yesterday if those analyses were rather dominated by a male and masculinist perspective. I comment on this because, as we know and as has been said by many on the panel, women are the subjects and the agents of globalization. And to see a lack of attention paid specifically to women is a very sad thing to encounter. Having said that, I want to say that my pleasure in working with Bill and Rich throughout all the years that I've been at Santa Barbara, with Rich in particular, is unending, and I look forward to more years of working with you. Perhaps. All right. I have some questions. I won't get a chance to get to the mic at the end, so let me. I would just want to pose some questions for the conference. Can trade ever be fair when we know that the East India Company is what led to the colonization of India? Do we want fair trade? I want to ask a question. What's wrong with charity? What's wrong with aid? Not aid is imperialism, like Teresa Hayter argued, but what's wrong with sharing one's wealth? How many houses can someone live in? How many meals can they eat a day? How many cars can they drive? How many yachts can they boat, or whatever the verb is? I need to get there. Just to know the verb, I mean, not to have the yacht. So I want to make that comment as well. What's wrong with charity in it? I just want to ask that question. Finally, I want to say that there are issues of language and representation that I won't be talking about today, but that when we talk about the bastards in the government, our children are also bastards, and let me tell you, they are nothing like Bush Yeehos and all the rest of them. When we talk about the dark side of globalization, let's just think about the images we're creating. So, now I've confirmed everything. Feminists have no sense of humor. We're very prickly, oversensitive, have chips on our shoulders, and wear jeans. All true. I want to start with an extract from a poem by Suher Hamad. She wrote a poem on September 11th, 2001 that was published in Meridians, which I don't have, and then she wrote a poem on September 11th, 2002. It's particularly apt now in the period of US occupation of Iraq, and the section is called What I Will. I will not dance to your war drum. I will not lend my soul nor my bones to your war drum. I will not dance to your beating. I know that beat is lifeless. I know intimately that skin you are hitting. It was alive once and hunted, stolen, stretched. I will not dance to your drummed up war. I will not pop spin break for you. I will not hate for you or even hate you. I will not kill for you, especially I will not die for you. I will not mourn the dead with murder nor suicide. I will not side with you nor dance to bombs because everyone else is dancing. Everyone can be wrong. Life is a right, not collateral or casual. I will not forget where I come from. I will craft my own drum, gather my beloved near, and our chanting will be dancing. Our humming will be drumming. I will not be played. I will not lend my name nor my rhythm to your beat. I will dance and resist and dance and persist and dance. This heartbeat is louder than death. Your war drum ain't louder than this breath. Ali Youn Diop wrote, there is no people without culture. But what is often lost sight of, the quite natural link, which I'm bound to mention for the sake of frankness, is between the political and the cultural. At a time when the present era marks a period of realignments in the cultural and political economies of the world, when protests against the WTO, the World Bank, and the IMF have brought together many constituencies that were previously quite distinct, as well as forced the supporters of globalization to show the extent of state violence they will use to ensure that global capitalism is not interrupted, it is clear that current times are marked by contradictions and realignments. Christian fundamentalists in the USA and Hindu fundamentalists in India traffic in images of female piety, yet use women to recruit other women to their cause, while often drawing on limited notions of female rights and autonomy. Elective plastic surgery for women has increased in the past decade in the USA and Europe. Genital cutting has been banned by Senegal due to the efforts of women's organizations. In rural Bangladesh, women's economic independence appears to be possible only through obtaining bank loans that require them to make handicrafts to sell to tourists, thus re-inscribing Euro-Western conceptions of third world women's traditionalism. Lesbian and gay groups are subject to increasing legal restrictions and monitoring in Latin America. Yet more people are prepared to engage in open protest against these measures. In Southeast Asia, throughout the Americas, as well as in Europe, sex work has become a site for discussion about the interconnections amongst women's agency, women's decisions to do sex work, women's work, tourism, militarism, migration, and masculinity. Janet Walker tells us that this is a period when satellite telephones are handed out by Red Cross workers, when websites are built by US college students to help unite Albanian families separated in the tragedy of Kosovo, when the greatest representation of East Asian women on the internet is as subjects of porn sites. It is clear that contestation, tension, and contradiction organize our lives. Politics has to take account of these unexpected and unpredictable outcomes of globalization. The question I want to ask today is, what forms of politics can move us towards a more just world? Many critics of globalization have analyzed global inequalities at a worldwide level. Yet rarely are the analyses discussed in terms of the differing consequences of the present era on different groups. But it is the peoples of the third world being a phrase that emerged from Bandung, the subaltern or the poor, who are mostly not white and whose labor and work ensures the success of the profit imperative that is the cornerstone of what is known as globalization. Brown and black people ensure that profit is created for the few, and most in this room are familiar with the argument that it is the productive as well as the reproductive work of women that secures the future of projects of globalization. Of course, the peoples of the third world are not homogeneous. As others have said, the UNIFEM 2000 report points out that globalization, or as Arundhati Roy says, life is profit, has benefited some women, the professional women, while simultaneously ensuring that more and more women enter the ranks of the poor. And the racism, Eurocentrism of hegemonic feminisms is another example of the difference of interests amongst women. Little of this is news to anyone in the room. The main characteristics of globalization can be found in Phil McMichael's work, and I'll skip over that, many are familiar. Globalization is seen as inevitable, but there is plenty of evidence to show that it is not inevitable. It is seen to be inevitable, but it is not. Thai peasants plant organic vegetables on over-irrigated golf courses, and the Shantals have worked to regenerate forests, a regeneration that was gender-specific so that women obtained the rights to the land on which the trees were planted. Women in Senegal working to eliminate FGC, female genital cutting, in their villages through their public declarations, bringing together hundreds of villages while also taking care of the women whose job it was to ensure that this work was conducted. Women who tap for rubber in Western Brazil have created organizations that increase literacy and challenge the domestic violence in their lives. These examples of development are actions that can resist the apparent juggernaut of globalization, for they ensure that development as planned social transformation and development as redistribution underlies their actions. In other words, what could make globalization unnatural and not inevitable is development. Mahbub al-Haq, who created the Human Development Index, said, "The basic purpose of development is to enlarge people's choices. The objective of development is to create an enabling environment for people to enjoy long, healthy, creative lives." There are problems with this notion. Choice, not rights, organize his approach. Yet it is an optimistic view of development. Amartya Sen has suggested that development be seen as freedom. But that begs the question of whose freedom? Freedom to exploit? Freedom to lead fulfilling, creative lives? How can and is development used to resist the horrors of globalization? I am, of course, aware that development has failed the third world. This failure, however, has resulted from an emphasis misplaced on modernization strategies, a lack of attention to women's contributions, and a disregard for culture. Why then focus on development? I do so because despite the failures of development, people engage with the contradictions of development, using development to create the possibilities for social transformation and redistribution of wealth and resources. I wish to develop a politics for social justice by learning from the sorts of examples I've mentioned. From my work and others, it seems as if development is realized, the possibilities of development are realized when development is centered on women, when culture is engaged with on a par with political economy, and culture is seen as lived experience, and human agency is foregrounded. These are the elements that form part of a new paradigm called women culture development that some of us are trying to take forward. And again, we've just edited a book and there's flyers in the back and so on and so forth. This women culture development approach takes as central that production and reproduction cannot be separated in the lives of all people, but seen most clearly in the lives of women. A WCD lens views women's agency as crucial. A WCD approach can interrogate issues of class, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and livelihood simultaneously. That is, WCD provides clearer ideas for a transformative development that challenges the ravages of the capitalism we are under now. I know this is very close to the politics of socialist feminism, and I'm well aware that socialism has little credibility as an alternative to globalization. The collapse of state socialist regimes across Eastern and Central Europe in the late 1980s and the demise of their organizational and ideological center, the USSR, have both strengthened global capitalism and its market ideologies and eroded the credibility of even the most reflexive of socialisms to critique and challenge capitalism and the ideas that sustain it. We can have many, perhaps lively, discussions about this erosion of the credibility of socialist critiques. Yet, it is the politics of socialist feminism which have built into them the rhetoric and idea of accountability for state actors. There's no accountability in corporations that provide an entry, this politics, into engaging with agency, resistance, and consciousness of people without drawing on discourses of people only as economic assets or as economic agents. There is a final reason why I work with the politics of socialist feminism, namely that all human beings have the potential to change ourselves and our social circumstances, even if such change has to come about in circumstances not of our own choosing. Borrowing unashamedly from two dead white European men whose work many here know well, let me quote. Globalization, which is not a word they used, and I quote now, stoops to pick up the golden apples dropped from the tree of industry and to barter truth, love, and honor for traffic in wool, beetroot sugar, and potato spirits, the Communist Manifesto. Might I suggest that we bring our minds to bear on how to ensure that truth, love, and honor do not continue to be bartered? Is it possible to reimagine development as justice? We urgently need to. Thank you.
We only have about 8 minutes or so left, so I'm not going to summarize or even highlight what they said, because I'm sure you all have questions or comments that you would like to share with us.
I was wondering if there were any strong trends regarding women's resistance leading or integrating with or being resisted by other movements in the third world. How the interaction between women's resistance and you know, say labor movements, other movements, whether the two were integrating, whether women's movements were leading them or whether there was resistance.
Who were you directing the questions to?
Your question is?
The women's movements and labor movements are integrating.
Yes. In the case of the Philippines, for example, Gabriela Philippines, which is the militant women's alliance in the Philippines has a chapter that is called KMK, and this is an alliance of women's workers, and they are linked with the national, with KMU, which is the National Alliance of Labor Movement, and this, and KMU is the militant labor movement. So they are usually linked, and the reason why that's linked, because Gabriela believes that there is, although we are tackling, for example, the question of gender, that men and women are also linked by class, especially in the Philippines, where transnational corporations would, for example, in capital accumulation, would use both men and women as source of cheap labor. But of course, we see that women experience, let's say, capital accumulation because of gender. However, we like to bring women's organization and activism, labor activism, also linked to the larger labor movement. This way, we have a united front, a united voice that's even farther linked to national liberation.
Just very quickly to say that when you look at the especially student activism through the United Students Against Sweatshop and other groups that are working on this question of sweatshops, there's a real connection between labor issues and women's issues, given that women are the ones who are working in these sectors for the most part. And more you actually hear, you know, I remember maybe five years ago, or even just around the NAFTA fight, that the language that was being used was of this question of the move to sweatshops production or to the maquila sector. It was characterized as good union jobs or good U.S. jobs going to the South or to the global South or going to Asia. And that language has changed as people are beginning to make the connection. And then also to say that in terms of the U.S. labor movement, big labor, where the union that is doing most of the organizing and recruiting and getting more union members is the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and they're the ones who are organizing retirement home workers, you know, nursing home workers, and other people who are working in the service sector, and they tend by far and large to be women. So that connection is, by necessity or by experience, is quite clear. And of course, labor union women, they're certain within big labor, there are certain coalitions, if you will, of just women within different unions, and then across sort of the federation as well.